Stephen Melching here, and you are listening to All Things Transformers.
I sense the taint of Primus.
Hello and welcome to All Things Transformers. I am one of your hosts, TF2 Mike, and joining me is Steve Megatron. Hello.
Hello.
In the latest ATTF interview, we welcome the writer of Transformers Prime, X-Men, Jackie Chan Adventures, Batman the Brave and the Bold, The Mask, and so much more, Mr. Stephen Melching. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. Glad to be with you.
Yes, very good, very good. Before we get started, can you give us the scoop on what's going on in the world of Stephen Melching? Any upcoming projects or any continuing projects you can kind of tease for us?
Well, I just had a graphic novel, a Clone Wars comic book, a digest-sized comic book from Dark Horse, came out about a month ago that I co-wrote with Henry Gilroy. It's bridges seasons 4 and 5 of the Clone Wars TV series and gives you some more background into Darth Maul and Savage Opress. And I've been working on the side some episodes of the new Hulk and the Agents of Smash TV show for Disney XD.
Sweet, sweet. All right. So where did you grow up?
I grew up all over this great nation of ours. My father was in the Air Force, and like most military brats, we had to relocate every few years as my father was transferred from base to base. So I was born in Colorado and subsequently lived in California, New York, Nebraska, Hawaii, Virginia, and back to Colorado.
Cool, cool. it would be interesting if ground bridges would have helped you move around a lot more easily.
Yeah, that would have saved a lot of a lot of time sitting in the back of the car.
Yeah. Did you always want to be a writer, or was that not your top choice for profession?
Well, when I was a little kid growing up in the 70s, I was all about dinosaurs, and I really wanted to be a paleontologist, and I read everything I could get my hands on about dinosaurs and used to draw pictures of them and even found a fossil trilobite in my driveway in Nebraska. But then a movie came out, or then I started watching Star Trek reruns
nice.
On TV. And became a big fan of that kind of stuff, too. And I was probably about 6, 7 years old when I started reading the credits on this show, on the TV shows. And the only credit I really understood was writer. I didn't know what a director was. I didn't quite know what a producer was or any of that stuff. But written by, I understood because I read books. And books are written by writers. So I thought,
right,
maybe I could write for television. That's a job. That's kind of cool. And I like watching TV and movies. Then a couple of years later, I saw a movie called Star Wars. You might have heard of it. And that just blew my mind. And I was 9 years old at the time and realized then and there, you know, walking out of that theater, that that's what I had to do. I needed to be create for movies or television.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw Star Wars. It was 86. I was 6 years old, and the first question to my mom that I posed at the end of the movie was, "Wait, that's it? It's over?" Because that ending is like, you know, the whole medals and it just ends, and I'm like, "Wait, that's it? Wow."
Yeah, but if you saw it in 86. You could go watch the other two right away. You could go to the video store and rent them.
That's true. That's very true.
I had to wait 3 years years to find out what happened next. And let me tell you, that wait between 77 and 1980 was interminable. Although, actually not as bad as that wait between 80 and 83, when Empire ended on that cliffhanger. Like, what the hell? Oh, my God. We were just hung, you know, in this pre-internet days, you were just, you know, hungering for any scrap of information you get your hands on. And, you know, we just read all those great magazines like Starlog and Cinefantastique and, you know, all that stuff, looking for
And the flip side of that now is that it's instantly in your hands, no matter where you get it from at this point with the internet. It's like a complete switcheroo.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Everything is so fast now from, you know, it's like you don't really have time to digest anything. It's like you're inundated with so much media, you know. But back in the day, we had time and sort of quiet to be able to sort of digest what we had seen. You know, we weren't able to immediately throw on a DVD or go on YouTube or download something, you know, to watch the next thing. You really had all that time to just sort of ruminate on what you had seen, which you know, that's the way it was. I can't say it was any better or worse, but.
So tell us the story about how you broke into the business.
Oh yeah. Well, following my, inspiration to be a filmmaker or writer, I tried to learn everything I could about how Star Wars was made, and I read all the books and watched the TV specials and stuff, and learned about this George Lucas guy and how he went to film school. And that was a revelation. Like, I could go to college and study movies and television in college. How cool is that? And he went to this place called USC, and my parents were from the Los Angeles area, and my grandparents all lived in LA. So I had visited from time to time. And, so I just set my sights on attending the film school at USC, and worked hard in school, got good grades, didn't do drugs, and got accepted to the school, and made a lot of friends there, and graduated, was out here in LA, and immediately just started trying to find work in the business. And initially, I wanted to be a film writer, and wrote some spec screenplays and actually sold one to Paramount that was never produced. But at about the same time, I had made a lot of friends at the Fox Kids Network, which in the early 90s was where it was really starting to happen. You know, that was, they were airing Batman the Animated Series and X-Men and Power Rangers and Tiny Toons and Animaniacs and all that stuff. They were huge. They were the biggest network around for kids programming at the time. And it was a very small operation. There were only a handful of people there. And I got to know everyone, but one of the programming execs there, Sidney Iwanter, who was the exec in charge of Batman and X-Men, most of the action shows there, knew I wanted to be a writer and encouraged me to read all the scripts as they came in, gave me free use of the copy machine there. So I would go and make copies of all the Batman Animated Series scripts as they came in, because I was a huge Batman and comic book fan also. And this was the Batman show I had been wanting to see all my life. So it was great to be able to read those. And I wrote a spec Batman script that impressed Sidney, and might have been passed along to the guys at Warner's had it not had the exact same story as a script that Paul Dini turned in the day before.
It was
uncanny. I worked on this script for 2 or 3 months, turned it into the executive literally the day before Dini's script came in, and it was the story Trial. Dini's was called Trial, mine was called Trial of the Dark Knight, and it was essentially Batman is taken captive inside Arkham Asylum and put on trial for his crimes against the criminals.
I love that episode. I know it's Dini's, but I so love that
episode.
Well,
the twist in mine that I'm very proud of is that Harvey Dent was both the defense and the prosecutor.
Oh, that would have been so awesome.
I think a lot better.
So I was crushed that I didn't get that chance because I love Batman. But Sidney, to his credit, you know, he thought it was a good script, and he said, you know, Batman is winding down. There's really not any opportunities there, but we got X-Men starting. You should write for X-Men. So he recommended me to Eric Lewald, who was the story editor on X-Men, and teamed me up with my old high school chum, Dave McDermott, who was working at Fox Kids at the time, and we pitched a story, an adaptation of one of our favorite X-Men comics, Longshot, to Eric and the X-Men team, and they liked our pitch, and they gave us a shot writing the script, and we wrote the script and didn't screw it up, so they gave us another shot, and we wrote another one, and another one, and another one, and we ended up doing 8 or 9 for X-Men, and from then on, I just continued to work in animation.
I see that one of your very first projects, and for myself personally, I really love this show. You worked on The Mask.
Yeah, that wasn't the first thing I really did, but I guess chronologically, however it aired, like the Longshot episode, I don't know, there were some production problems with a cluster of episodes that for X-Men that they'd sent to a different studio, and there were horrible delays overseas and a lot of retakes and stuff. So that episode was the first episode that Dave and I wrote, but it was actually probably, I don't know, the 8 or 10th that actually made it to air. But The Mask, yeah, that was working for Bob Skeer and Marty Eisenberg. I think that might have been the first project I did for those guys. Marty had also been working at Fox Kids as kind of his day job while he and Bob were writing scripts for X-Men and all those other shows.
Yeah, I blame IMDb because that's how they have it listed under your writer credits, is they have The Mask listed very first in 95, and then if you move up...
It does have X-Men, but they put it up farther because it lasted longer.
Yeah, and you know, who knows? It might just be the air dates. I don't remember. As I recall, the very first episode of animation that I wrote to actually air was the X-Men episode Weapon X Lies in Videotape, the big Wolverine flashback Weapon X episode. Yep. And they actually aired that in prime time.
Oh, cool.
But that was the fourth episode, I think, that Dave and I had written for that show. But, you know, so it had aired. I don't know. Anyway, that's, yeah, IMDb.
Yeah. No, I mean, I know a lot of people will sit there and review the old X-Men cartoon and be like, this animation is crap. These stories are crap. I'm looking at it, I'm like, what is wrong with you people? This stuff was amazing. This to me was, this show, the X-Men show, the Spider-Man show, regardless of what the animation or the bleeding colors or whatever, the stories in the cartoons made me want to go read. Like, I never really got into comics before cartoons. Like, cartoons made me to want to go get comics. That's what it was. And those X-Men stories just brought so many things to life. I actually just watched, again, I went on Netflix and I watched Weapon X Lies in Videotape today before we did the interview.
There's some crazy stuff in there. I mean, we had Jebediah Creed beating his son, basically, in that episode.
Yeah.
And we did another one called Descent that took place in the 19th century in London with the origins of Mr. Sinister and the mutants, where we had their ancestors on the trail of Jack the Ripper. And you actually see, like, the foot of one of Jack the Ripper's deceased victims in the foreground in one shot. It was pretty crazy. And we had debates about evolutionary theory, natural selection. In that episode, that was kind of a transitionary series between that and Batman. Those were sort of the new wave of sort of mainstream, more sophisticated storytelling.
Yeah.
I guess you could say. Before that, it was Super Friends and stuff like that. When it came to action adventure, there really wasn't a lot that sort of took it seriously and did more complex types of storytelling. So, you know, the Batman show had a lot more money for their animation and music, which was tremendous. You know, I mean, it was a really beautiful show, and it sounded fantastic. You know, Shirley Walker's score was fantastic. X-Men, you know, Haim Saban, he's not a man who was known for spending a lot of money on his productions. What's that? I'm sorry?
I said, hence why we have Power Rangers Turbo.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, I wrote a couple episodes of that, too. And, you know, that was a show that was produced, you know, on the cheap, but was hugely successful for them and obviously continues to be successful to this day. So he was doing something right there. I remember going into the offices there when they were just thinking of buying the show to put on the air, and Dave and I watched an episode of the Japanese version, and we thought, is this a joke? You're going to put this on your network? Are you going to do it like MST3K and have people making fun of it? And, you know, they had a vision, and they put out that show, which was, you know, you can't argue with the success of that show. It's huge.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think that, like you were saying with the evolution of the shows, I really do agree that in the early 90s, that pretty much set the tone and the future interpretations of all the comic book hero animation.
Yeah, well, I went to school. One of my good friends from film school was Brian Singer, who directed X-Men and X2, among others, and the X-Men animated series was a huge inspiration for him when he was putting together the first X-Men feature film, and he watched the entire series, and, you know, he wanted to capture something of that tone or that sort of serious approach to the subject matter and the allegory of, you know, mutants' rights, you know, being an allegory for, you know, whether it's, you know, for civil rights, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And then the next thing that I kind of knew you from was the sequel to Beast Wars and Beast Machines. Oh, my God, I love that show.
Yes, that was another show I did for Bob Scarabardi Eisenberg. That was a real treat to work on because I was a fan of Transformers from G1. I used to come home from school, from high school, maybe a little too old to watch it, but I've always loved watching cartoons. I come home from high school in Colorado and turn on the TV, and that was in the 80s, so I was watching G1 Transformers and G.I. Joe and Thundercats and all that stuff. And actually, Dave McDermott and I went and saw the original Transformers, the movie, in the theater, and we were the oldest people in that theater. When we watched that thing, we're teenagers. we're the oldest people in there watching this thing. So I had been a Transformers fan going back to the beginning and had a collection of toys that I still have. I still have my original Optimus and Megatron, which I was pleased to go get signed by Peter Cullen and Frank Welker during one of our Transformers Prime recording sessions.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
You lucky...
Yeah, I got my Starscream, and you know, I got about a dozen of the original G1.
Oh, that is awesome!
Toys in their boxes because I was one of those weird kids that saved everything. I still have most of my boxes to my original Star Wars toys.
Oh, sweet! Yeah, with Beast Machines, it was such like we interviewed Larry DiTillio a couple of years ago. And it was during the time, because we actually did a full-on Beast Wars, Beast Machines review podcast, where each podcast episode we would review 2, 3, 4 episodes of each cartoon.
Oh, cool.
And we interviewed Larry DiTillio, and I was like, so, Larry, if Beast Wars went into season 4 and season 5, what would you do with the characters? He goes, we'd probably send them back to Cybertron. I'm like, that's interesting, because that's what happened with Beast Machines. But no, Beast Machines, what's so funny about that is you have, you know, a comical yet sinister character in Megatron and Beast Wars. In Beast Machines, he gets so much darker.
He was especially scary around, in that show.
Yeah, he is scary in that show, especially around the time when he's trying to separate himself from his organic half. Right. I thought he loved that organic half, though.
That show was, I have to admit, I had never really seen Beast Wars before working on that because, I mean, that was the late 90s. I don't recall it being readily available on home video formats, so I couldn't just get tapes and watch them, and I don't remember it being on television at the time. I had to work on the show, and you know, it all came together relatively quickly, so I was sort of writing in a vacuum with that series.
Yeah.
With regards to Beast Wars, I only knew what I had learned from the Bible for Beast Machines that Bob and Marty wrote, and our conversations. Like, we would gather over at Marty's house with, you know, Bob and Marty and me and like Marv Wolfman and, you know, some of the other writers would get together and we'd discuss the stories that we wanted to tell and the relevant background, you know, backstory material.
Yeah, I just love, for me personally, I what I love about those two series, and I know you mainly only had dealings with Beast Machines, but between the two series, they are, Beast Machines is most definitely a sequel to Beast Wars, even though it does stand on its own with its own story, but just taking those characters and putting them on a barren Cybertron was just such...
Oh, yeah, and I think the mainframe did a terrific job with, you know, realizing those environments and... You know, doing a CGI show has, and we can get into that later if you want, has its own set of challenges when it comes to the storytelling. I mean, it has its strengths and weaknesses in terms of animation, and also its strengths and weaknesses in terms of, you know, the stories you can tell. And I thought that was a really clever move on Bob and Marty's part, because those sort of artificial environments always look better in CGI than a natural environment, especially back then. And the idea of doing all these drones, you know, the Viacon drones, gave the villains a large, you know, contingent of, you know, versatile enemy forces that the heroes could go up against, and you could make some really epic, dramatic stuff.
Oh yeah, and I just love that there was no rubber ducky in Beast Machines.
I need my rubber ducky. Yes.
We interviewed David Kay a couple of years ago for the Beast Wars show, and I had Steve do his Megatron for him, and he's like, "Wow, that's like pretty much second best to mine."
Yeah.
Funny thing is, I actually did it at TFCon, and people were looking around like he was there.
Oh, it's so great.
Yeah, what I really liked about Beast Machines was Bob and Marty were not afraid at all to go into the metaphysical realm, you know, and it was really, we really sort of explored those concepts of the Allspark and, you know, the afterlife and stuff like that. I thought that was, it's kind of religious in a way.
Yeah,
it was really interesting.
It was nice. It added new depth to the whole history of it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. And then I didn't even know, because I actually spent, I don't know, 2.5 days watching all 39 episodes of this series. I didn't even know at the time that you were a writer on the 2002 Masters cartoon.
Oh, yeah. I think I did 6 episodes of that for Dean Stephan. That was another show I watched after school, He-Man.
Yeah.
And that was a little young for me, even for some high school kid who was watching cartoons. He-Man was a little young for me, and it was mostly just sort of, I hate to say background noise, but, you know, I just had the TV on when I was working on my Dungeons and Dragons stuff, because, you know, of course I was a dungeon master when I was in high school, which I think was terrific, was great training to be a writer, because...
Yeah.
You know, back in those sort of pre-computer days, you want to do adventures like that, you needed a dungeon master to sort of create the world for the players and create a storyline for them, to go, a quest, and a, you know, storyline. And you had to be able to think on your feet and improvise to, you know, when the players might want to do something you didn't intend for them to do, you got to, you know, keep the story alive for them.
Yeah, and that's the great, like... I love, because I grew up watching the Filmation He-Man and She-Ra and all that stuff, and I love that for what it is, but once I found the 2002 series, I'm like, yes, continuity, strict continuity, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, one flowing story, amazing.
Yeah, Dean Stephan is a terrific writer, and you know, really had a good vision for that show, along with the I guess he was the producer. He was I mainly knew him as the Mattel executive, but I think he has a producer credit on the show. Ian Richter, who is a great guy and is one of the most passionate young executives I've ever worked with. I mean, this is a guy who just loved the material that he was working with, and he's the guy that would get up and act stuff out in the room. You know, I mean, he just loved his material, whether it was Max Steel or, you know, Hot Wheels or He-Man. He was 110% committed to that material, and kept pushing us to make it cooler and more, you know, more exciting, and sort of tamp down the Mattel instincts to want to throw in every, you know, crazy toy they wanted to include in the show. Like, okay, well, can we find a way to stick that in there that's not ridiculous?
Yeah.
But that was a fun show to work on, and when we came on the idea of bringing in the Snake Men, I thought, oh, you know, if I do a really good job in the Snake Men, the first Snake Men story, that seems like a kind of a... I had a choice of episodes to do, and I picked the one... or a choice of concepts to develop, and I mm-hmm. went with the Snake Men because I thought, you know, if I do this right, they might want to bring the Snake Men back, and I'll be their go-to writer for Snake Men stories, and... That actually worked out pretty well. Like, I'm almost every story I did was a Snake Man story. So.
Awesome. Very, very awesome. All right, now we're going to jump into what all of the listeners actually want to talk about and hear about, which is...
Jackie Chan Adventures? Current... Oh, no, I'm sorry. Transformers.
The current project that you're working on, the epic Transformers Prime. Now, I've heard on the... on the season one DVD set, I forget which person said it, but someone said that they hope that Prime is, you know, some parent's child's generation one, essentially. You know, that, you know, fans of the old shows will get their kids into this, and this will be that child's G1. And I totally agree with that. First off, I love the entire series. So, you know, so far, all of the episodes to me play like one big long story. Like, to me, there is, and I know people will nitpick and say, oh, well, this is a throwaway or that's a throwaway, but every episode always has something that connects the entire story.
I agree. There's always some element, and it's not necessarily, you know, it's not a strict serialized, each episode flows directly into the next with a cliffhanger or some giant mythological overarching story. It's often just, you know, character threads, emotional threads, or plot threads. You know, there's usually always, you know, generally there's always something.
Yeah.
You don't approach any single episode of that series as simply a throwaway. We always want to explore, you know, at least one character and do something new, with the storyline.
Right. Was it a goal of the writers to homage all generations of Transformers in Prime? I mean, there are homages everywhere to multiple generations, yet the story is its own and very unique.
I wouldn't say that was... it certainly wasn't a mandate. And I'm... as far as the people in the writers' room, in season one we had... four staff writers, myself, Marcia Griffin, Joe Coor, and Nicole Dubuque, and then Dwayne Capizzi, who was credited as a producer, supervising producer, but he is also in charge of the writing staff. And he's sort of, as far as the writing goes, the last word in terms of what we do. And we run everything past Jeff Klein, our executive producer, who is a very shrewd, smart guy. He's terrific. And then, of course, everything also goes through, you know, the network, Hub Network, and Hasbro brand signs off on everything. But as far as the people in the room, I was probably the one person in there that came to the room with the most knowledge of Transformers, of the Transformers universe. And it was never really something that I pushed in the room. But at the same time, I mean, our even though they sort of set up Prime as being part of this, I think they call it the aligned continuity.
Yeah.
Hasbro came to this show with a desire to create a single continuity going forward that would include their video games and books and comics and television series. Not really the films, although we echo the films in some ways.
In a few of the designs and stuff like that.
And some of the story concepts and visuals and stuff. We echo the films, but they're not part of our continuity.
As much as the little kid in me wants Dan Gilbazan,
we couldn't have the base be in a like a dam, like Hoover Dam, because they had their base in the dam in one of the movies.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I think our base is cooler anyway.
It is. It's so much cooler. And as much as the 6-year-old in me wants Dan Gilbazan's voice to come out of Bumblebee, I'm glad. I'm actually probably the only person that is glad that the Bumblebee in Prime is R2-D2 beeps versus radio stuff that happened in the movies.
In the beginning we toyed around with maybe doing that kind of stuff with B, but that was just going to be too complicated to try to do, and thought, screw it, he'll just bleep and we'll kind of understand what he's saying through context.
And through Raph with all the exposition.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if I answered your question. We were never sort of beholden to any past continuity from the previous series. We didn't want to, but we were respectful towards it. We didn't want to do anything that was outright contradictory to something that was important to, a character or storyline or something. And, we would have our writer's assistant, Marigrid, who also has written episodes in the show, is very knowledgeable about the Transformers universe, and she would always have her computer out and could look stuff up on the different wikis, and, we'd have reference books. So often when we were looking for something to use in the series, whether it's one of the sort of MacGuffins that we've used or locations on Cybertron, we would do our research and try to find something that has already existed and plug
instead
that
of creating
in.
Something new.
And we might put do a different twist on it, but that became sort of our way to homage the earlier incarnations of Transformers.
Right.
And it'd be for probably most viewers watching it, they have no idea that when we say you make some of these references that it's actually something from a previous series, but for the hardcore fans, we hope that they will appreciate those little nods.
Oh yeah. We hardcore fans get a lot of those references, and it's just amazing.
It's fun for me, 'cause I like doing, and I think Joe Coor likes to do research also. It's fun to go in and to the wikis and try to find something really cool. Like, what can we do to, bring back to have fun with in some way.
Yeah. All right. I know this probably is going to get a no, but can you reveal any new characters coming up in the ending of season 2?
There's not many episodes left in season 2 that haven't aired. Let me think. I
know we just got Smokescreen.
You just got Smokescreen, and we saw Alpha Trion for the first time, and we saw Shockwave.
Yeah.
Is
Shockwave going to be coming back? Can you tell us that?
I would say what Jeff Klein has said, which is in doing these kind of CGI shows, it's very expensive to create a new asset for a show, whether it's a character or a location or a prop. Each one of those things has to be designed, and especially a Transformers character, it's not just a single build. It's, from what I understand, they have to build it 3 times. They have to build the vehicle mode, the robot mode, and the transformation. So it's expensive to build a character. So when you see someone like Shockwave turn up for one episode, it's a pretty elaborate build, and we tend not to let things like that go to waste. So I think it's safe to say that you will be that we will be seeing him again.
Cool.
Nice.
I try explaining this to a couple friends that that just don't get it. But in Prime, that has to be the most unique way of bringing Unicron into the story. How is that thought out? I mean, Unicron is the center of the... Oh my god, my brain broke when I saw that.
That came out very early, actually. I want to say possibly it was the first week of our writer's room. Back in 2009, October 2009. It might have even been the second day, but it was definitely the first week. And that was a really fun week because that was the four staff writers, Dwayne Capizzi, Jeff Klein, Margred, I think Margred was on board by then, and then we had Roberta Orsi and Alex Kurtzman in the room, as well as some of their people from their production company. They're people that are like Mandy Safavi and Roth Ruthchild and some of their guys were all just throwing ideas around. And all we really had to go on at that point was a Bible that wasn't particularly fleshed out. We mainly just had the major characters and the tone of the show. And Dwayne had an idea for the story for the beginning of for basically part one of the.
Yeah. That's
just for the series in general. And one of the people in the room, I don't remember how it came out, but somebody just said it in the room.
And just make Unicron the center of the Earth.
Yeah, Unicron is the Earth, and there was like a half beat where it sunk in, and everyone was like, "Oh, we have to do that. That's awesome." So that's
now,
so that became the genesis of that. So we knew that literally from the first week of creative meetings on the show that we were going to do that.
Wow.
Are there any other type characters that you guys have been itching to try and pull in there or haven't been able to?
Oh, you mean Autobots and Decepticons that we want
to
use in the show?
Yeah, or even
or
some
human?
Of the yeah.
Well, we it's I mean, there are such a large number of characters in that universe, and I know we would love to have more characters in the show, especially early on, but it just was simply not in our budget to create those characters, simply from a budgetary standpoint, but also from a storytelling standpoint. It's difficult with the premise of our show, with a small group of Autobots sort of stranded on Earth, and Megatron and his crew there trying to not only hunt them down, but, you know, reclaim all of the Energon that had been stored there during the war. It becomes an issue of what do you do with all of those characters if they're all around? I remember running into this problem back on the original X-Men series where we had like 8 or 10 X-Men as part of the core cast. And after a while, you got to figure out, well, what do I do with all these people? The show's only 20 minutes long. You know, everyone's got to get a line. Everyone's got to do something cool. Or, you know, why doesn't this kid, you know, it becomes a challenge in the storytelling. So if Megatron had, you know, he's outfitted with this army of sort of essentially clone soldiers, basically, that have just sort of rudimentary personalities. They're not real characters. But if we had, you know, 24 characters, you know, Thundercracker and, all these different name brand Decepticon characters with personalities, everyone would be constantly wanting to see them in every episode. Like, well, why wasn't so-and-so there? Why wasn't so-and-so there? Why didn't he do that? And it just becomes unwieldy to try to manage. We call it traffic control. You know, like, how do you manage that many characters in an episode?
Yeah.
So for
I would think that you could introduce not necessarily. It's almost like what you guys did with Wheeljack, where you introduced him, he went away for a while, and he came back, and he's kind of with the team, but he's not. I would almost think, and I don't know where you guys are going to go with the story. I'm itching to find out with season two and season three eventually, but I would think that characters, they wouldn't have to be in every episode. You could just, you know, continue the story and, you know.
That's true. And with the Autobots, you know, there's, what, five of them, five core Autobots at the base. Yeah. The problem there is they're kind of stuck there in that base. I mean, they have a ground bridge so they can be sent around the globe to do different missions and stuff. And we've done that from time to time, like, you know, Bulkhead's out on patrol or RC's checking out an Energon reading or something like that. That's easy enough to do, but if you have a larger contingent of Autobots, you start to wonder, like, well, all those guys are off doing, what are they doing? Or could what they're doing be more interesting than what we're watching now? Or, you know, why don't we see them? Or why don't they come back, you know, when there's a battle? Why don't they radio for help and they come back and join, you know? It becomes difficult to manage. But I will tell you this. You will be seeing more new characters in Season 3.
Nice.
Both Autobot and Decepticon. So we were able to expand our cast.
Very cool. Very cool.
I don't know if that's set. I don't know when Season 3 is actually going to air. I don't know if they've announced that
that's
yet.
That's okay. That's okay. How many colors of Energon are there? Because you've got seriously, you've got the blue Energon, which is the good regular Energon. You've got the purple stuff, which is the dark Energon. Now you've got red Energon that Starscream found. I mean, what's and you've got synth Energon, which is the green stuff. So you got four colors right there. What's next?
Yeah, I think we're done with Energon flavors. Hasbro sent over a. We were kind of looking around for inspiration for stories, and we were thinking about, you know, like the old Superman comics where there's all those different types of kryptonite that do different crazy things to Superman.
Right.
And we had already introduced the concept of, you know, there's Energon and there's dark Energon, and we had the idea of synthetic Energon. So we thought, well, are there any other types of Energon? And Hasbro sent over a chart, and there were like 8 or 10 different colors on there. There's one that was like a Chronogon, I think it was called, or something, like a time displacement Energon.
Oh, wow.
There was, what else did they do? You know, there are several others that exist in the Hasbro pantheon.
Right.
We won't be, as far as I recall, we won't be seeing any more new Energons beyond those four. That said, you have not seen the last of Dark Energon or Synth Energon, or Red Energon, for that matter.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. I don't know if this is a Hub thing, a Hasbro thing, or if it's on, you know, the directors and producers side, but why is season 3 only going to be 15 episodes? Is that a budgetary thing, or it just seems like, I don't know, it seems like it's a short season there.
Well, most series, that was always the plan going in, more or less. Most TV series, once they hit 65 episodes, they don't need to make any more in order to make money. They can syndicate them overseas. It's not as big a deal here now. It used to be here. You wanted your 65 episodes. And once you hit 65, you can keep going. But for the company, for a lot of the companies, it's like, you know what? We could keep spending more money making additional episodes, or we could just stop and syndicate these and make something new. And so we went in at the very beginning hoping to get to 65. I mean, it was never a guarantee, but it's rare, or it's unusual, for a lot of shows to really go beyond 65.
Well, I wish it would, because it's such a great series. What were you going to say, Steve?
I said, so here's hoping that we get another few seasons on top of what's already been confirmed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can't confirm anything, but I don't know. It's we came into it knowing how we wanted to end the series. So we weren't rushed into anything, and we were very happy. The way it's proceeding is we're very happy with season three.
With the current storyline in season two being when it's airing, it's being, you know, it's the Omega Keys and the Omega Lock. A friend of ours is hoping that Cybertron is not going to come to life and transform.
That's funny you should say that. We, in the early discussions of Unicron being at the core of the Earth, we were thought like, will he transform? Will he bust out of the Earth? Is that going to be an issue? And we actually early on thought about this image of this like giant hand erupting out of the crust of the Earth, like this, you know, the size of a, you know, half a continent or something. And it was a really cool image to think about. And then we thought, you know, that's kind of ridiculous. That would kind of destroy everything, wouldn't it?
So it'd be a quick way to end the series.
Yeah.
Boom, here we go.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah, I don't know. Can we get any season two ending or season three beginning teases? Anything that you could give us would be lovely.
Well, I could probably reveal this because I think it will become knowledge within the next few days anyway. The title of the season two finale is Darkest Hour, and at least it was last I looked.
Okay.
I had to change at the last minute, but it's an apt title. It really puts Team Prime at their darkest hour. It's our sort of our Empire Strikes Back ending. Mm-hmm. Season two does not end well for Team Prime. And I hope we'll make people really eager to come back for season three and see how the heck they get out of this. I've heard there are complaints about our show always resetting to status quo, and there will be no doubt that we are in a whole new place for season three.
Wow.
It's not the status quo. Is not. It will not be an issue in season three.
Yeah. I've always said, lately with the history of Transformers between the films, and not necessarily Prime, but between the films and the games, what I really dislike is how the classic line of one shall stand, one shall fall, Optimus will start it and Megatron will finish it. Really, really dislike that. But what I really love about Prime is how you guys work in classic lines, like in the episode where Optimus got the Star Saber that just aired a couple weeks. I think it was Legacy.
Last
week's episode, when at the end in the Nemesis, it pans to Megatron and he says, "This is truly the Decepticons' darkest hour." I just cracked up so much because I thought that was just so amazing how you could just twist the line around. Oh,
yeah.
Made you feel bad for him.
Yeah. that's always a fine line and kind of a judgment call on how much or how often to do those kind of dialogue callbacks, because mm-hmm. it can be groan inducing, like, oh, for God's sake, they're saying that again. And that was an issue in the Star Wars, the Clone Wars also, where, you know, we were all huge Star Wars fans working on that show and wanting to find different ways to insert sort of classic lines of dialogue. And maybe we did that a little too much in the early going, but it was kind of irresistible because it's just cool. But,
and it's such a switch around, though. It's not, you know, it's not Optimus just saying it. It's not him lying on a stretcher with, you know, his Matrix in his hand or anything like that. And because it's Megatron saying it, it makes it that much more epic. And I didn't groan at all at that line. I found that amazing that was written in there.
Yeah, we like to do stuff like that when we can. And the actors like it too. And let me tell you, that recording room, that's one of the most fun things. I mean, it's fun to be in the writer's room and sort of plot out the scenes. It's hard work because we'll be in there day after day sometimes, just, you know, throwing ideas around and sort of plotting out every story. We break every story in the writer's room with the whole team. And when we use a freelance writer, we usually, if we can, we'll bring the freelancer in for that session. But the show is so continuity heavy that we write almost every outline internally and then give the outlines to our freelancers to do their scripts from. Because it's just a lot to ask for the freelancers to try to learn, you know, 40 episodes of prior continuity.
Oh, yeah.
It's much easier for us to do it and guide them.
Yeah.
But I don't know why I'm completely lost my train of thought. Oh, the fun of the writer's room. So it's great. It's a lot of fun to throw out ideas, and some, you know, often, as often as not, the ideas go down these sort of blind alleys. Like, wouldn't it be cool if that? Oh yeah, and we'll talk about something for a couple hours, then realize there's really not a story there. And other times, you know, a little digression will lead to a great story. And so that's a lot of fun. And then at the complete other end of it is going into the recording studio with the cast, who are just a delight to work with and just so much fun to be in the booth. And, you know, some of those guys are, you know, they're just hilarious. Nolan North and Kevin Michael Richardson and Steve Blum and Jeffrey Combs and, you know, and obviously Frank and Peter Cullen. I mean,
that would
these are
just
guys
be
that
epic.
They're just hilarious. Sorry?
I said that would just be epic sitting there listening to those guys.
Oh, yeah. And they, you know, between takes, they'll be in there telling stories or goofing off and telling jokes and stuff. And you know, Kevin Michael Richardson particularly just goes off on these crazy, you know, they do conversations in different characters, and it's just a blast. That's always the most fun part of any show I've worked on, is getting to go to the recording session. It's like having your dessert at the end of the meal. You know, you just get to sit back and listen to your script come to life and socialize with, you know, really interesting array of characters. Like I remember when we brought in Tony Todd to be the voice of Dreadwing. I was a big fan of his from Star Trek: The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and I just had to totally, you know, drop my professionalism for a minute and geek out with him over an episode of Deep Space Nine that he did called The Visitor, in which he played an elderly Jake Sisko, which is, if
you've
never seen this episode, it's one of the most
That's awesome.
It's absolutely fantastic. You know, it makes me weep every time I watch it. It's just a brilliant hour of television, and he was very grateful, you know, that people remember that work.
Yeah,
rewatching the show, I had forgotten he played Worf's brother. And I had seen every single episode of Next Generation Deep Space Nine, often multiple times. I had completely forgotten until I rewatched one of the Next Generation episodes that Tony Todd played Worf's brother, Moog.
Wow.
So it's fun when people like that come in. We have cool guest stars come in. And you know, we had George Takei in, you know, playing Alpha Trion. Fun to get to meet him.
I find it very funny that George has now voiced two Transformers elders. He voiced Yoketron in Transformers Animated, and now he's Alpha Trion in Prime.
I didn't realize that, because I actually never got to see Transformers Animated either. Marty Eisenberg approached me about working on it in the very beginning, about writing for it, and I was interested, and I read the Bible. But at the same time, I just wasn't available. I think I was working on, I had a commitment to another series or something, so I just never had time to work on it. And I just never got a chance to really watch any of the episodes. But I hear it was fun. I don't know. I didn't see it.
Yeah. Getting into some of the convention areas, have you ever been to any of the fan conventions? Or do you have any thoughts on going to them?
I love conventions. I've been going to conventions for 30 years. I used to go to the creation conventions back in the day, and there were a couple of sort of literary conventions that I went to. And I've been going to Comic-Con San Diego for almost 20 years now, and I go to WonderCon in San Francisco. And I've been to BotCon when they had it in Pasadena a couple years ago. And that was a lot of fun. I'd probably go to those are the main ones I go to. I love conventions. I love walking around the dealer's room and looking for cool stuff. And I like going to the panel discussions. Although at Comic-Con, it's become really difficult. That's a whole other rant. San Diego Comic-Con now is just unwieldy.
It's too big.
It's too big. It's a victim of its own success, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It's too big and too expensive. But I still go. I keep saying that I'll keep going until I can't get a hotel room there anymore. And I've been resigned to not going to San Diego Comic-Con for about the last 3 or 4 years now. But I put in my hotel request, and I keep getting hotel rooms. Like, okay, I guess I'm going this year.
That's
but
awesome.
I know the day will come when I fail in that lottery, and it's like, okay, I guess I'm not going this year.
Would you like to inform the fans of where they can interact with you online or anything? I don't know if you do Twitter or any of that kind of stuff. I know you're on Facebook, but I think you pretty much keep that to.
Yeah, I don't really have my Facebook page is just a personal page. I don't have a fan page, and I'm on Twitter, but if you follow me, the joke's on you because I don't really tweet. I just kind of use it to follow people, mostly comedians. I'm accessible and happy to talk to fans. If they come up to me at a convention or something, I'm always happy to talk to fans. Because I appreciated the time that professionals before me took the time to answer my stupid questions or listen to my my nerdgasms.
Yeah. Before we let you go, remind the listeners of what you have coming up or what's currently going on with you as far as your writing stuff and whatever else.
Well, Transformers Prime, I have an episode that I story edited that's on not this week but the following week called Inside Job that was written by Bob Skeer, and it was a fantastic script. And I haven't seen it yet, but I heard it turned out really well. I'm really proud of it. And then I wrote the season 2 finale, Darkest Hour, which is totally epic. It's awesome. Haven't seen any of that either, but I was really proud of the script and how it turned out, and really excited to see it. And, of course, season 3 of Transformers Prime, I wrote 5 episodes in season 3. And Marcia Griffin wrote 5 episodes of season 3. So we wrote the bulk of season 3 internally.
That's awesome.
We could finish out the story the way we had, it was such an inside baseball kind of show anyway, it was so mythological, so myth heavy at that point that it was easier for us just to do it all. So, between me and Marcia and Dwayne and Marigrud, we wrote, probably 80%. Of season 3, and then the Clone Wars comic with Sith Hunters and Hulk and the Agents of Smash coming to Disney XD. I don't know when, next year sometime.
Cool. We'd like to thank Mr. Melting for taking the time to chat with us in this All Things Transformers interview. We will ask you to hold the line, and we'll be back after this.
Who in the pits of Kaon is that?
So there you go, folks. That was just slightly north of an hour-long interview with Stephen Melching, writer from Batman the Brave and the Bold, X-Men, The Mask, Transformers Prime, Beast Machines, Batman the Brave and the Bold. It was awesome talking to him.
Yeah, it was really really fun and nice getting to hear some of the background thoughts on the various series he's worked on.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell he's a huge Star Wars buff. He's a huge superhero comics buff. And he's a huge Transformers fan as well, and that's absolutely amazing.
He's a geek like the rest of us.
Yes. I don't think he heard me, but in the interview when I asked him a question about the multicolors of Energon, I made a Skittles joke, and I don't think he heard me because I said, "See the rainbow, taste the rainbow."
That is funny. I didn't catch that either.
Yeah.
Usually I'm the first to say, "Taste the rainbow."
That's just creepy, dude. I wonder how it would sound if Megatron said it.
"Oh, taste the rainbow." Yeah.
That's even more creepy. But there you go, folks. We had a fun time, absolutely amazing time with Stephen Melching. He's a great, great guy. Amazing writer. Transformers Prime Season 2 is currently airing. We're not sure just yet when Season 3 will air, but go check this show out. You know, keep an open mind about it. I know most of you G1ers are like, "Oh no, this isn't my Transformers."
But it's the G1 for the new generation, and in my opinion, it is the best show since Beast Wars and Beast Machines. And I will argue that it's pretty much neck and neck for me, even though I'm still biased.
Yes, we know.
But yes, I do love that show very, very much.
All right, so there you go, folks. We will catch you next time on All Things Transformers.
Anything else you'd like to mention that we already know?
Nothing I can say in front of the children. We Decepticons now face our darkest hour.